means changing North Woods, what it means for the future. The composition of the forests in Maine is changing. Maine's hardwood forests are losing maple trees and birch trees and gaining more beech trees, which are prone to bark disease and less valuable than the other species. Maine's legendary white pine faces a threat from a fungal disease, and the dreaded emerald ash borer is on our borders. All of these changes have consequences for Maine's environment and forest economy. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Why are Maine's forests changing? Is it climate change, human practices, or something else? What can rural communities do to adapt to these changes and maintain a sustainable forest economy? We'll talk with three professors at UMaine who approach these questions from different perspectives. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For some, Maine's North Woods are a place for recreation. For others, they are home and the source of income. Today, we're going to learn about how those woods are changing, both because of climate change, invasive species, and because of changing economic conditions. In the studio with me, three faculty members from the University of Maine's School of Forest Resources. Sandra de Urioste Stone is an assistant professor of nature-based tourism. William Livingston, associate professor of forest resources. And Adam Dagno, assistant professor of forest conservation and recreation policy. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about changes in Maine's forests? The challenges and opportunities that come with that. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here. And Professor Livingstone, I'm going to start with you. What are these recent changes in species composition? How do the Maine woods look different than they did even 50 years ago?
Well, we're seeing our species that I would call more opportunistic coming in because of the various changes that are coming into the forest. So we're seeing more balsam fir, we're seeing more red maple. And across the region, outside of Maine, over to New York, we're seeing more American beech. We haven't seen much changes in beech within the state, but when you look across the Northeast, we're seeing a dramatic increase of beech in other locations.
So do you expect that to happen here as well because it's happening in other Northeastern states?
That's trying to look into the future and its potential. We've seen it happening elsewhere, and that if we get similar conditions here, then we could also see a similar trend with beech here in the state.
How are the changes in the sort of past 50 years different than the trend of changes in the last 200 years? What are we seeing now that we didn't before?
That because we've seen so much use and harvesting in the state of Maine, that we're seeing species that come back after disturbances or in sites that are disturbed. And balsam fir and red maple are very well adapted to those conditions. So that's why we're seeing an increase in those species.
All right. Professor Dagno, what does that mean for traditional resource-based industries, the changing species?
Yeah, so what basically means is that the kind of main resource that people have been used to harvesting could, the level of abundance might not be there anymore. On top of that, there have been some changing policies like limiting of clear cuts and things through the Forest Practices Act, which has changed sort of how we actually can manage forests, and that's driving some of the changes as well that Bill is talking about. So there's definitely an abundance of the kind of key species that a lot of the traditional industries are still looking to utilize, but the ability to sort of get in and get them is changing from that perspective, that it can be more costly to do so.
Let me ask you about that. So you're saying the change in the way we harvest and the reduction in clear cutting has, and let me see if I've got this right, has made it possible for more opportunistic species to come into Maine?
So it to some degree, yes, that's the case. So it's the way that management has been undertaken in the last 30 years has kind of shifted dramatically. We used to, particularly up there, more than 50% of the land was clear cut to some degree. That's since changed. So what that does is it in terms of how forests can regrow, it allows different conditions for those species that are kind of more shade tolerant to move in.
I see. So if there's a clear cut before, the forester could go in and plant a whole swath of whatever species he or she wanted to, and now
the plants that can grow naturally when there's a shady, not bright sun condition. I'm not a scientist.
Right. And so this is a bit more back to Bill, so he can correct me if I'm a bit off on this. But basically the idea is, so there is not a lot of planting being done in the North Maine woods. Uh-huh. Never has been. It's one of the natural conditions for what we call regeneration, which is kind of the natural seeds falling on the floor and growing is some of the best in the world. So, but what it does do is it promotes certain types of species that can grow the regeneration from being exposed to sunlight is a lot easier for some species than others.
Okay. Yeah. The switch we're seeing is that before we had a lot more red spruce, and that because of the practices over the last 20 years, we're seeing less red spruce and more balsam fir. And we're seeing less sugar maple, more red maple. So we're seeing kind of with the current climate we have now, we're always going to have forest. We don't have a dry season. The conditions are almost always good for regenerating trees, so we're going to have trees coming back. But we're seeing kind of this shift in species, going away from the longer-lived species to those that are shorter-lived.
Okay, and so a shift from sugar maple to red maple, does that mean potential harm to the maple sugar industry in the long term?
Well, the people who are interested in sugar maple syrup, they're managing for sugar maple. So in the sites where people want to maintain sugar maple, we know how to maintain that species. And in those locations, we can maintain the sugar maple.
Professor Uraste Stone, I want to bring you into the conversation. You study sustainable economic development. How does a changing forest affect planning when you're looking at things like ecotourism?
Yeah, so a changing climate also affects how we're thinking about the resources that we have available for recreation, for tourism, also thinking about how our potential clients are changing also in terms of what they want to pursue, what type of recreational activities they want to do in our state. So we want to make sure that we can match the resources that we have and the changing resources that we have to the changing needs of the visitors that are coming from other places.
So give me an example of something as you do tourism planning that you're thinking about concretely, what people used to do versus what they may want to be doing in the future.
So in the past, we had a lot of hunting, traditional hunting, fishing, camping. We see much more visitors that want to do like stand-up paddling, do more non-consumptive types of recreation, like viewing wildlife, hiking, camping.
All right. And how do you help rural communities plan for that kind of future?
So we help them identify what are the key strengths of their destinations, what are the kinds of activities that visitors are expecting to pursue, but also the type of services that they want. We know that in the past we had a lot of visitors that Dr. Richard Judd from the History Department would call them rusticators, that would come and didn't mind the wilderness and not having a lot of services provided. But now we see more trend stores having visitors that want to enjoy the outdoors, but also have all the commodities that they have in their home places.
All right. Adam, as we look at the kinds of trees that are growing in greater numbers in Maine, are there opportunities in those kinds of trees? I mean, maybe they're not trees that are good for paper, but are they good for something else?
So depending on who you talk to, most people in the industry, they would say no, that a lot of the species that are coming in are not necessarily considered economically rich. So which is, it's why some people kind of are really into thinking about how can we manage against this. The beach concern, I think, is definitely one. Again, that hasn't hit northern Maine nearly as much as some other regions, but that's definitely a case or a call for concern. I'd say, though, that, you know, as if this becomes closer to the norm, people become opportunistic and basically figure out new ways to basically utilize the resource. So, even though it might not be the most optimal use for things like paper or whatever, there could be new industries that figure out how to take advantage of the resource that's there.
So what kind of opportunities might there be? What kind of products can we make out of spruce?
Right. So you can make 2x4s and things like that. kind of one of some of the emerging industries are ways to utilize the wood to do what's called cross-laminated timber or mass timber. And the idea there is that you can essentially create a product that's basically can be competed with things like, or substituted for things like steel and concrete that kind of has those strength and properties to allow you to kind of construct high-rise buildings and stuff out of that. And things like you can use what's out there now to do that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the threats that aren't from management but are from bugs. Professor Livingstone, we've heard an awful lot about people have been tracking the emerald ash borer, which we know is confirmed in states that are near to us and also now in Canada. But we post something from the University of Maine site, a film that you were part of about the eastern white pine. I mean, this is, as it says in the film, the tree that built America, and it's threatened. Explain that to us.
The threats to it are primarily that if you neglect it, you're going to have problems with the tree. That it regenerates very well, and especially here in New England, but it can come back in very dense stands. And when it's in the very dense stands, it becomes very vulnerable even to our native pest and pathogens. And so the threat we see there is primarily through the lack of management. That if people come in and take care of the white pine stands, regulate the densities to keep the trees growing at a proper spacing, they can maintain very healthy and very valuable trees. But if it gets neglected, there will be pest problems that come in and result in quite a bit of mortality for the trees.
Adam, you're nodding. Though the Great North Woods is vast, are we capable of maintaining all the white pine stands?
That, yes, there are landowners in the state that do a very good job at managing the white pine. And I have to say, most of the white pine is in the southern part of the state. So up in the northern part of the state is where we see more of the spruce and fir conifers growing.
Anything you want to add, Adam?
No, it's just that is that the landowners and land managers that recognize the value in certain species, they are putting a lot of effort into managing for that. Again, within limitation of what the policies allow.
So this fungal pathogen, Calliceopsis pina, am I pronouncing that right?
Close enough.
This is really not sort of a big existential threat. It's something to watch for if you don't manage your stand.
It's just something you see naturally in populations. Populations will naturally produce more offspring than what can be sustained in the environment. And so there are a number of organisms that have evolved with species, Calliceopsis being one of them, that as these dense stands compete with each other for the resources, the Calliceopsis will take out the trees that are the weakened state. So over a matter of a few decades, it will thin out the stand, and the strongest trees will survive that period and then continue to grow. But in between, you've had a mortality of really over half the stand that would have occurred.
All right. Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Bill, I want to return to something you said just a minute ago, that we will always have forest because of the amount of rain that we have. Is that because of climate change, or is that how it's always been?
Well, for at least probably the last 1,000 years, that's how we've had been. The spruce fir forest actually was not in the Maine region until about 700 years ago. And that's when I would say we're now experiencing our current climate, where we don't have a dry season. If you look at our precipitation, it's pretty well evened out throughout the year. And that is just ideal for growing the trees. So that's something that we've had around here for probably at least 1,000 years. And from what I've seen in the future, we can pretty much expect similar precipitation. The one uncertainty is increasing temperatures, if we might start getting a dry period in the summertime, which would then begin to affect the species that we have here.
All right. Sandra, when it comes to nature-based tourism, what are the challenges for rural communities?
So some of the challenges that we are experiencing in terms of nature-based tourism is having, for example, broadband available for visitors that are coming to the area. We're also experiencing problems with infrastructure, transportation. And although that was one of the big opportunities when tourism started to develop in Maine, using narrow gauge railroad systems, steamboats, with the changes in trends in visitation, we feel like transportation or access to those rural destinations is one of the biggest challenges that we're experiencing. And as I was mentioned earlier as well, the different types of services that visitors are expecting also requires these rural destinations to think about what things can they improve upon and upscale their services.
You know, we've done programs on Maine Calling, and you all, I'm sure, are well aware from working outdoors of the fears about things like Lyme disease and anaphylaxis. Do you find that tourists are changing their behavior because of fears of tick-borne illness and the spread of them?
So we've been doing some research on what things worry visitors and change, impact their travel behavior. And one of the key things that we've been hearing is their concern towards increased ticks and increasing Lyme disease. So some visitors are rethinking where they're going, what time of year they recreate, and what type of activities they're going to be engaging to reduce their risk.
It sounds like that might be some opportunity for the winter, though, for folks who might like to cross-country ski or go snowmobiling.
Exactly. If the weather conditions permit, we're hearing from some visitors saying, yes, I don't recreate anymore in the summer, but I come here in the winter when I know that the deer ticks are not going to be a concern.
All right. Well, we're talking with three professors from the University of Maine. They're all in the forestry department, the Maine School of Forest Resources. What are your questions about the changing North Woods of Maine, not only biologically, but also the opportunities and challenges for the future of the economies that are based there? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine General Thayer Center for Health's Comprehensive Outpatient Center. Learn more at MaineGeneral.org. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com. And Stillwater Environmental Engineering, providing environmental engineering and compliance assistance. StillwaterENV.com.
On the next Fresh Air, a feminist journey through the science and culture of pregnancy. We talk with journalist and mother Angela Garbus. In her new book, she writes about the incomplete research into the effects of alcohol on antidepressants on the fetus, what the placenta does, what's really in breast milk, and the anatomy that makes childbirth so difficult and painful. Join us.
Tonight at 7 o'clock, here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Radio is taking part in a national survey on the current and changing media habits of public radio listeners around the country, and we need your help. You may be among randomly chosen listeners who recently received an email from Rob Holt, our Director of Digital, asking you to take this national survey looking into how you use radio, social media, smartphones, tablets, streaming, and the web to stay connected. Thanks in advance. This survey will allow us here at Maine Public Radio to better serve you in the years ahead here in Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Maine's Changing Forests. Joining me in our Bangor studio, Sandra D. Urioste Stone. She is an assistant professor of nature-based tourism. Adam Dagneau is assistant professor of forest, conservation, and recreation policy. And William Livingston is associate professor of forest resources. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Yellow Light Breen, President and CEO of the Maine Development Foundation. Yellow, welcome back to Maine Calling.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
Yellow, what role does the Maine Development Foundation play in conjunction with the North Woods?
Well, we work on long-range economic growth strategies for the state, and we are working with a cast of many leaders from industry, from community, from the University of Maine, both forestry and R&D departments, on what's the long-range pathway for the forest products industry, and what are the diversification opportunities for a lot of these hard-hit communities that relied on the jobs from the woods. And I would say, listening to your panelists, the common thread between the ecological changes and the economic pressures is that we think we've got to be forward-looking, we've got to be long-term, and we've got to be really comprehensive in our approach if we're going to sustain jobs and grow new jobs from the Maine woods.
I know that you're working hard to identify markets and products for Maine forestry. What's promising out there? What are you excited about?
Well, some of it is to leverage what we're already good at in terms of a very strong sawmill industry in Maine, which is always the highest value you can get out of a tree. Certainly, the paper companies we have are diversifying into new markets like tissue and packaging, and that kind of nimbleness is important as old markets go away and we're not reading the newspaper anymore. And we're trying to look at the products around the world that have the fastest growing demand where Maine can compete, and to kind of tie it back to the changing nature of the woods that folks have been talking about this hour, to make sure we don't woo the wrong industries that are just going to compete against existing mills in Maine. A lot of the mills that shut their doors were softwood-based mills, and so there is 2 or 3 million tons of excess supply, essentially, of softwood fiber in Maine. So finding those products that are innovative and or already here that Maine can compete in, that use the wood fiber that we know Maine will have in coming years, that's why it's got to be long-term and comprehensive.
All right. Tell us about the Forest Opportunity Roadmap.
Well, that is this group that I'm talking about. We've got all the segments of the forest products industry, from landowners to sawmills to paper mills to truckers and loggers. And I think that's the key, is folks recognize we've got an incredible history in Maine, an incredible infrastructure in Maine, but it needs to evolve, and everyone's got to work together. And then we're working with the university folks. They're the ones helping us with things like a really dynamic wood supply analysis. So you can match up the global market demand with the wood supply we're actually going to have and figure out how to move to those new opportunities. The private sector will decide what to invest in, but if we've got incredibly limited resources in terms of what to invest in R&D, in terms of what to invest in new roads and bridges, in terms of what to invest in the efforts of the Maine International Trade Center, we really want to know what we should really be putting our center of energy around.
Well, Yellow, thanks for joining us today. That was Yellow Light Breen, the president and CEO of the Maine Development Foundation. We're going to go to Bill, who's calling from Durham. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Oh, hi. I just moved to Maine about 5 years ago after spending 11 years in Montpelier, Vermont. And this storm back in November, to me, was just a catastrophe for the woods in my within a radius of about 20 miles around here. I've never seen so many trees knocked flat with their roots sticking up in the air. And I can't help wondering if it's not related to climate change, if there's a new normal creeping in where there's severe drought in this case of all through August and September, and then we had really, really heavy rain for 2 weeks, and it just set the stage for this really our forest just taking a huge clobbering. Just everywhere you look, there are just pines shattered, trees, as I said, with roots up in the air over and over. A little woodlot on my property lost about 6 huge poplars. So anyway, I'm just really concerned that this might be a growing trend.
Sure, Bill. I'm seeing the same thing in the woods that I like to, where I like to walk my dog. Bill Livingstone, is that possible? Is it the climate change is making our forests more susceptible to big storms?
Our forests have always been susceptible to storms. It's the primary, what we call disturbance. That's the primary reason that we lose the older trees and the young trees replace them, is due to trees being blown down. So that's always been happening in a forest. As to what happened to last November, I think as the caller, or Bill, mentioned, is that there was probably some unique circumstances that came together. The dry season would reduce the amount of root growth, and the wet conditions. I think we're referring to the Halloween storm, October 31st. When we had gusts up to 70 hurricane force winds come through. And so that loosened up the soil, where now the what normally would hold the trees in, the soil is now loosened to where it come over. And then something our forest supervisor, Keith Canody, noticed is that where most of our wind storms are nor'easters, where the wind comes out of the northeast, this storm was different in where the winds came out of the southeast. So a lot of the trees that that had blown over, say, from the nor'easters, these other trees weren't vulnerable to that. But because we had this unique combination of dry followed by wet plus winds out of the southeast, we're suspecting a lot of trees that had been protected before and under these conditions just got to blow over. So it was a unique set of conditions. If we continue to see these conditions happen more frequently, then I would expect, yes, we'll continue to see more trees blow down.
And Bill, our caller, links this to climate change. Bill, our professor, do you as well?
Well, that's getting into the area about predicting what's happening with the climate, and so that's outside our area of expertise. All I do know is that if these conditions do become more frequent, then yes, I expect to see we're going to have more problems with trees blowing down.
All right, Bill, thanks for your call. Go to a Facebook post. This is from Gary. I would love to see the North Woods of Maine be less extractive and more value-added and recreational. Northern Maine has an abundance of untapped recreational opportunities. We could easily become a recreational mecca. Sandra, is he right? Can we become a recreational mecca?
Definitely. And just last week, we were in Greenville, where a group of recreation planners got together with different leaders from rural destinations, trying to figure out what opportunities can we tap into so that we can continue exploiting our beautiful resources that we have for recreation.
All right, Gary, thanks for your post. We will move on to Bob calling from Bangor. Hi, Bob, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I wanted to say I think Bill's point, the earlier caller, is very salient and important, and I agree with him. He's implying that, certainly suggesting that climate change is driving these alternating drying out and severe rainstorm conditions, and that's generally, that is one of the effects of climate change in general. I wanted to talk about, before you mentioned beech trees being opportunistic and taking over because of lack, at the end of clear cutting, because they're shade tolerant, which is true, and that's interesting to know that there's going to be more. I think you said this is going to happen. It hasn't really quite happened yet, because the beech is one of my favorite trees. But what I'm wondering is this. What about oak trees? About 6,000 years ago, oaks were everywhere because it was either 6,000 B.C. or 6,000 years ago, because there was a general drying over the whole planet, I believe, after the glaciers withdrew. So there were oaks everywhere because of the drying conditions. I'm wondering is, with the generalized drying conditions induced by climate change, how will that interact or interfere with species like the beech being flourishing? Because the beech likes moist deciduous woods. It's one of the principal species there. I mean, is there any chance that oaks might come back in any proportion because of, I think there will be more drying, and there has been drying in Maine. I mean, we haven't had a full-scale drought, but there have been these pretty dry periods in the last 15 years that I've been living in Maine. So,
Bob, go ahead. I'll have our professors answer the question. Anybody looked into this?
We're talking about the oak trees. We have the forest type pine oak, which would be white pine and red oak. And that's an important forest combination in a number of areas of the state. And I would expect if we were to start getting more drier summers, that I would expect these species to become more prevalent in the area. And where we know how to regenerate white pine very well, and that where people want to encourage that species, we can do that. We're much less certain about the red oaks. And the main trick there is trying to understand better what favors the regeneration of that species to make it more successful. And so that if people are looking towards the future and want to hedge their bets and saying, well, they should have species that can survive the drier summers better, the white pine, red oak combination are a fantastic species to deal with those conditions.
And Adam, are oak trees valuable resources from an economic point of view?
Yeah, to some degree, you can get oak quality veneer and things like that as well. I'm not aware of how large the industry actually is from that perspective, but you can definitely make some quality wood out of that.
All right, Bob, thanks so much for your call. We'll move to Rich, who's calling from Moosehead Lake. Hi, Rich, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm developing a small sugary on the shores of Moosehead, and just wanted to make a comment about how the state has been managing the woodlots around Moosehead. They've been extracting a lot of sugar maple, and a lot of it ends up in firewood, and I wish I'd see the state go in the direction of trying to preserve it for sugary. It would make a great sugary up here on the slopes of Little Moose and Big Moose Mountain. But I had one question about the beech bark disease. I've been extracting all the beech out from under the maple, but leaving the ones that aren't diseased. And I was told that possibly because they weren't harmed by it, they would seed a healthy beech wherever they did. Because I do know my young sugar maple need canopy to develop. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Glad you brought up this topic about the beech. Yes, there is a beech bark disease, and that unfortunately affects just about every stem of beech we have in the state. It's a small insect, aphid-like insect. It's called a beech scale, and that lands on the tree and just sucks the juices, the sap out of the tree, and has a little white cover on top of it. And that just weakens the tree until a fungus can come in and start creating cankers. And so you'll see beech is supposed to be a smooth bark tree species, but when you look at most of the beech in Maine, they're just covered with these small cankers, indicating the disease. But as the caller indicated, we do have resistant beech. The estimate is about one or two per acre. So where you could have thousands of beech stems per acre, there's going to be one or two in there that will show the resistance, meaning that you do not see the insect on the tree, you do not see the cankers. And our current recommendations is to save these trees, to preserve these trees, because this does inherit it. Studies have shown that half the seedlings coming off these resistant trees will be resistant themselves. So this could really help the beech population in the state. And in fact, Aaron Bergdahl with the Maine Forest Service down in Augusta, I've heard, is wanting to actually map these trees, that if people find a likely resistant beech tree, we'd like to know the location. And so we begin to gather this database of where we do have these resistant trees so that we can help the species improve its resistance to this disease over time.
Is there somewhere Rich or others can turn to find, help identify the resistant trees?
There are websites dealing with American beech that will explain the disease, but the main part is to find the resistant trees. They're generally going to be 8 inches or larger at diameter, about 4.5 feet up from the ground, and they will have perfectly smooth bark and no white growth, no white insects feeding on the trees. If you see a tree like that, it's very likely resistant.
All right, Rich, thanks for your question. Email from Tracy. Hidden Valley Nature Center in Jefferson, Maine is part of Midcoast Conservancy. HVNC is not your typical nature center. It is 1,000 acres of sustainably managed FSC certified forest land with 25 miles of trails for hiking, skiing, and non-motorized use. It has 6 yurts and cabins for overnight use. More than 50 educational programs include timber framing, chainsaw safety, and forest management. Value-added forest products include timber frame buildings, tables and benches, lumber and firewood. Our mission includes teaching and demonstrating the best possible low-impact sustainable forest management while contributing to the local community in many ways. Sandra, is this unusual, or are we seeing a creative and innovative land trust dealing with forests all over the state?
Yes, indeed. This is one of the areas of opportunities and growth that we're seeing. Conservation organizations and land trusts focusing on providing recreation opportunities either for visitors or also for residents and students. And again, as we're bringing these stakeholders together, we're trying to figure out what ways can we use recreation and visitor use to promote economic development for communities, but also to support conservation efforts.
All right. Simon on Facebook writes, can you ask your guests about the Land Use Planning Commission's new adjacency and subdivision rules? Big changes could be in store for North Woods. Adam, this sounds like a question for you. No, you're making a face.
I'm aware of the rules, but I can't speak that much on exactly what they're going to entail from that perspective. I know there is a lot of concern up north, particularly around the rules, and coupled with that, ideas around or concerns around deorganization of towns as well as the area changes. So, But beyond speaking about knowledge, and awareness, I can't give too much insight.
All right. Thanks for your question, Simon. And we do have to take another quick break. But first, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about preventing, diagnosing, and treating melanoma. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Local 188, Spanish cuisine, fine cocktails, and local art since 1999 in Portland's West End and at local188.com. And Houston & Company, designers and builders of custom fine furniture with a showroom and workshop in Kennebunkport and online at houstonandcompany.com. And Fader Lee Law, dedicated to providing effective counsel on all matters of land use and real estate in Maine. Learn more at FaderLeeLawMaine.com.
Intelligence Squared U.S., where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate is Bitcoin more than a bubble.
All the best engineers in the world are working on Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is the pets.com of the cryptocurrency world.
I'm John Donvan. Join me for a debate on the future of Bitcoin, the next Intelligence Squared U.S.
Coming up shortly at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
House Republicans are headed for a confrontation on immigration that's pitting conservatives and moderates against each other.
The true challenge here is, can you get a compromise? Can you get a bipartisan bill? Can you get something not only to the Senate, but the Senate will take up and get signed into law?
The internal drama is testing the staying power of Speaker Paul Ryan and his heir apparent. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Changing Maine Forest. Joining me, Sandra De Euroista Stone, Assistant Professor of Nature-Based Tourism at the University of Maine, William Livingston, Associate Professor of Forest Resources, and Adam Dagneau, Assistant Professor of Forest Conservation and Recreation Policy. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, we were talking about what's going on in Jefferson at the Hidden Valley Nature Conservancy. And Professor Livingston, you think that this is a really good example of something.
Yeah, I think it's really good. I've been in Maine for 33 years, and I'm still learning more about the state. But what's clear to me about the Maine way of life, the forests are important, but it's for all aspects of it. And I think what they're doing down there is just fantastic. They are managing the forests. It's just an extraction, but they are managing the trees down there, doing harvests, it sounds like, for FSC certified, but doing it to improve the forest. And it's for all uses and to integrate in the recreation opportunities along with the managed forest, I think, is fantastic. And from what I've seen, is just really carrying on through tradition of using the forest here in the state of Maine.
Did you want to add to that, Adam?
Yeah, so I think it was great to touch upon sort of the land trust and sort of the idea behind not just what's going on down in Jefferson, but kind of throughout the state with there's kind of been an emergence of land trust type ownership and conservation ownership that this day and age is close to 3 million acres. I know some people, when they hear that and hear conservation easement, they think sort of land being locked up. But it's actually the Jefferson example is spot on to what's really what most of those conservation groups are doing. It's actually 85 to 90% of the land under easement are working forests that are actually doing sustainable timber management. Nearly all of them are certified by a third party verifier in terms of providing sustainable timber. But then they also basically lock that land up from development, but not necessarily from recreation and other types of uses. So it's really kind of unique aspect of what makes Maine, I think, to have the most sort of privately held conservation land in the state.
All right. We'll go to Ralph, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, Josh. Thank you. I believe that the Maine forest and actually the Northeast forest is very unhealthy. And there's a couple of reasons why. We don't have a lot of cedar trees anymore, cedar groves, which is very important for the deer and the tick, believe it or not. The deer used to sleep under the cedar trees hundreds of years ago. And the ticks don't hang around the cedar too much. the more cedar, the less ticks. And it's the whole Northeast. They have been, the wood products industry has decimated the cedar groves, and they need to be replanted immediately. And then they need to be fenced off a little bit so the deer doesn't eat the small trees and let them grow big, and then the deer will settle underneath them again to sleep.
All right, Ralph, thanks for your call. Thoughts?
I do know that there's been issues with the amount of cedar, northern white cedar, in the state, and that the regeneration of the species seems to be lagging behind what we've seen from other species. I know people have been working on it. The industry that actually depends on the northern white cedar for shingles is very concerned about it. But unfortunately, I'm just not quite sure what they found to date about what are some of the issues and what it's going to take to help increase the amount of cedar we have in our forests. The issue has been recognized, and I know there's been work being done on it, but I'm not quite sure what the progress is to date on that, understanding the problem.
All right. Thanks for your call. We have an email from Deborah, who's a wildlife ecologist. She writes, "While timber production and forestry are the backbone and heart of our economic history, we can't forget how important forest habitat is to the ecological health and local nature-based economies. One of your guests mentioned a concern about more beech in our forests. Beech nuts are a veritable superfood for wildlife. They are a nutrient-dense food source for black bear as well as white-tailed deer and more than a dozen other mammals and birds." Interesting, Deborah's email and our last comment about ticks and deer. I mean, everything's interconnected. You can't consider one part of this story without considering the other parts of it, can you?
Exactly, and that's why we feel it's so important to bring different stakeholders together and listen to the different views and use research to help us create these new informed strategic plans.
Okay. The one issue with the beech is, again, the beech bark disease, and that does affect the beech nut production. So that's, we can get a lot of beech coming back, but a lot of them are diseased, and so slow growing and presumably not producing many nuts. So that's the real dilemma we have in working with the beech, is because of this invasive insect that's come in and affected all the trees, that it's no longer productive as what it used to be.
So while we're on the subjects of insects, the emerald ash borer is of high concern. What is the very latest, Professor Livingston?
For some reason, Maine has had a charmed life, and we do not yet have the insect. We're probably the last spot here in the Northeast where the insect has not been detected within the state or province borders. So that way we're fortunate. But Maine Forest Service expect that it's going to be here. It's actively out looking for it. And then once it's here, we're going to have to deal with it. But kind of put it in perspective, I've looked at the ash populations in Michigan, which has had the insect in for 20 years and has a forest composition somewhat similar to what we have here in Maine. And after 20 years, you're going to expect to see a big change in the ash population, and that'll probably be about half the number of trees of what we currently see. So it's going to have a big impact on the forest makeup, especially where ash is present.
And hemlock woolly adelgid continues to be widespread, correct?
It's along the coastal areas. Fortunately for us, this insect is sensitive to winter temperatures, and the expectation is that it might move 10 to 20 miles inland from the coast up to about where Mount Desert Island is. And that's probably where the insect is going to have adverse effect on the trees. It may go farther inland, like we've seen with balsam woolly adelgid, make its way up to Moosehead Lake. But for the most part, those hemlock are not going to die from this insect. So fortunately, the hemlock mortality, that if you're along the coast, eventually the hemlock are likely to be killed by this insect. But move inland very far, the hemlock are likely to survive.
Well, we're going to move inland, and we're going to go to Mike in Van Buren. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
I grew up in Van Buren, and, you know, for years and years, armies of woodcutters and chainsaws went to the Maine woods that were managed by Great Northern Paper Company. And, you know, that's all changed in the last 15 to 20 years. It's, you know, Irving Woodland has moved up there. They have these giant machines that come in, and they basically work 24/7. They cut huge clear cuts, and they plant monoculture, you know, red spruce or black spruce forests that are 220 acres, 200 acres in size. They leave a 50-foot strip of natural woods between that and the next clear cut and plant that in the same species of trees, and then 10 years later go and take that little strip out and plant that. And, you know, they put, they spray the forest of these planted areas with a spray that kills all the deciduous trees. And basically it's just becoming a giant monoculture forest between, let's say, Route 161, north of 161 to the Canadian border. And it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres. And I understand.
Sure. Mike, do you have a question?
No, I just would like to hear comments about whether or not the guests think that's a responsible management of the forest.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay. Irving is a company that pays very, very close attention to the forest, and that they have their system for managing the forest that meets their company's objectives. So I will say, from what I know of the Irving operations, what they decide to do well. Whether people agree with their approach or not, that I understand also is something that is part of the debate. But I would say Irving Woodlands, when we look at other landowners within the state, they're a company that definitely pay attention to what's going on in the forest. They look at their futures, meaning they've got to have forest there in the future. And what they do very well. But how they do it, I understand, is going to be something that people are going to agree or disagree with.
Thoughts, Adam?
Yeah, and I'll tie that in with Irving Woodlands. They were basically one of the first groups to sign into what's called outcome-based forestry, which is essentially opening their books up to be audited and watched over by the Maine Forest Service in terms of what practices they're doing, how they're doing them, and with an objective of basically, you know, having an outcome of good forest management while also meeting their economic objectives. So from a policy standpoint, they're kind of adhering to what's kind of appropriate and kind of going out on a limb by trying to make some things that are a bit different than maybe how forestry's normally been done in Maine. But that being said, it's still, I think in Maine, we're quite used to this idea that you can have lots of different species around and kind of just this plethora of different species and options, where forestry in a lot of other parts of the U.S. are very much more plantation-based and things like that, which maybe have people, you know, questioning things here, whereas other places it's very, very much the norm.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call. We'll go to Roy, who's calling from Naples. Hi, Roy, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling about to ask about the American chestnut. I'd read that there was some American chestnuts had been discovered in the Maine woods. They'd been almost completely extirpated by disease. But I understand there have been a few discovered. So I'm just wondering if your guests know if there's any chance of a revival of the American chestnut. Thank you.
Oh, yes. The American Chestnut Foundation has very much an active program for trying to reestablish the chestnut in our eastern forests. And we do have an active chapter here in the state of Maine, and they are actively planting chestnut at various locations in the state that are show some resistance to the disease. And these are our hybrids. They've actually bred American chestnut with a Chinese or Asian chestnut, and then back cross, so that we're getting 75 to 90% of the genes within the tree are Native American chestnut. And these are being planted within the state to try and see which, if we have some trees that can grow well within our climate. So they're very interested in trees that are showing resistance within the state, so that can become part of the program. But they're already actively planting resistant trees within the state to try and help get this tree reestablished in our eastern forest.
Roy, thanks for this question. David on Facebook asks, the forestry person mentioned that a small percentage of beech trees are resistant to the bark disease. Is this also true of the emerald ash borer, where some trees don't succumb to it?
I've asked people in Michigan about this, and they generally say no, they have a hard time seeing it. I think it's just now getting to the point where they're finding some of the resistant trees. But I do not see really in the future of that being the solution. Usually what happens with insects is there's some natural agent, some parasite that starts affecting the emerald ash borer itself, and that begins to regulate that. We've seen that with gypsy moth here in the Northeast. Up until the 80s, we used to have a lot of defoliation of the gypsy moth in the forest, but now there's a fungal pathogen of the insect that generally keeps it from ever defoliating trees again. So that's my expectation with emerald ash borer. It's not going to be resistance of the trees that's going to build up. It's going to be natural regulators are going to build up within the emerald ash borer population. And I don't know how many decades it may take to get to it, but eventually to where the population becomes naturalized, to where it becomes self-regulated within our forests.
Okay, we can cross our fingers.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go to Lawton calling from Penobscot. Hi, Lawton. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Hey, I've got some healthy beech trees, and I'm about 8 miles from the ocean and about 330 feet above sea level on the Blue Hill Peninsula. I'm a small farmer. And a forester told me about 30 years ago to cut the diseased beech in the dead of winter, and if I had to cut the healthy ones, to do it in the spring. And I think that's helped bring more healthy trees onto my property. I just wondered if that was still the practice. And then also, I understand beech trees have pretty extensive root systems, and I think there's mushrooms and all kinds of stuff that come along with that. I just wondered what your experts had to say.
Okay. With the beech trees, yes, they have an extensive root system. And in Maine, a lot of the regenerated beech we have here are from sprouts. The beech sprouts prolifically either after a harvest or after a parent tree has died. You will get sprouts coming up, not from the seeds, but from the roots in the soil. So it sprouts excessively. As for when to cut it, I've heard a number of different recommendations as when to cut the trees. One study I know that the U.S. Forest Service, Maine Forest Service, carried out indicated that cutting in the wintertime will result in less sprouting, and summertime results in more sprouting. But then they found that the mortality of the summer sprouts was much higher than the winter, and after a few years, it ended up being about the same.
Hmm.
So I think if you're interested in getting resistant beech, the main thing is to preserve those resistant trees and encourage the beech nut production and seedling growth.
All right. Well, Lawton, you're going to be our last call this hour. And I want to thank my guests who are talking about Maine's changing forests. You just heard William Livingston, an associate professor at the University of Maine. He teaches forest resources. Also here, Sandra de Urioste Stone, an assistant professor of nature-based tourism at the University of Maine, and M. Dagno, assistant professor of forest conservation and recreational policy at UMaine School of Forest Resources. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had help from George Thomas and Rich Tozier. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.